Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with David A. Black, co-founder Ruby Central, co-founder of Ruby Conference, and the Complete Rubyist. David A. Black is an international top-ranking Ruby programmer, author, trainer, speaker, and event organizer. David, you have a lifetime of outstanding contributions in a number of fields, and we really thank you for sharing your expertise, insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, I'm very glad to be chatting with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, David, you know, I was looking at your background. I noticed that you work with Cirrus Innovations. Can you give me a brief outline about this company?
Sure. Cirrus is a consultancy based in New York City. And essentially, it is an agile development consultancy. So we do agile process, and we also do development and do a kind of mixture of coaching and development with our clients. And I've been there for about 14 months, started at the toward the end of 2009.
Well, that's really interesting, and it sounds like it's a great venture to be at as a senior developer. Now, sort of going into more detail about some of the things that you do in your background, what are some key lessons from the well-grounded Rubyist?
The well-grounded Rubyist, I would say, when I was writing the well-grounded Rubyist, the project actually was a kind of offshoot of a previous book I'd done called Ruby for Rails. And I say offshoot because it was kind of a second edition, but really a sort of reworking and so forth. And the purpose of the book, and this was true of Ruby for Rails and all the more so of the well-grounded Rubyist, I would say lesson number one from the well-grounded Rubyist is to actually know what you're doing. I've always, in my teaching and writing, I've always kind of emphasized this idea that if you really know what's going on in the language, if you really understand the Ruby object model, how Ruby works, what makes it tick, and so forth, you'll be in very good shape, and you'll be able to really kind of bootstrap yourself into the learning process. So I would say that the well-grounded Rubyist is my kind of, you know, position statement, so to speak, on really knowing what you're doing and understanding what's going on. And there's a little bit of background to that. When I wrote Ruby for Rails, that was when the Rails web development framework had more or less just come out, or was about a year old or something when I started writing the book. And I had a concern that a lot of people were kind of flocking to Rails without necessarily understanding Ruby. So I wrote Ruby for Rails in the hope of educating people who were coming to Rails and didn't really know Ruby that well. And I think that that worked out very well. And then that sort of morphed, as I say, into the well-grounded Rubyist, which is not a Rails book, but is a Ruby-specific book. And I like to think, among other things, that the sort of Rails generation of Rubyists had come of age. A lot of people were saying to me, you know, I really liked Ruby for Rails, but why don't you write a just Ruby book? So I did, and that's where that comes from.
Well, there's literally, what, hundreds of thousands, perhaps, people that are reading your works and following them. Now, you have this thing called a Complete Rubyist, and it's sort of really fascinating. Can you sort of just give some background about the Complete Rubyist, and then, you know, what are some little-known tips from the Complete Rubyist?
Yes, I'd be glad to talk about that a little bit. This is a project that I am doing, or have been doing, or continue to do with two friends and colleagues of mine, Gregory Brown and Jeremy McAnally, both of whom are Ruby programmers, programmers in general, and all three of us have written Ruby books. Jeremy wrote or co-wrote Ruby in Practice, and Gregory wrote Ruby Best Practices. And we were talking, this was a little over a year ago, we were talking amongst ourselves about sort of some of the similarities, some of the ways in which our books kind of complemented and fit in with each other, and just started thinking it would be really cool for the three of us to do something together. We talked about book promotion. They're with different publishers, so it didn't really go in that direction. But what we decided was that we would do some joint Ruby training. We thought it would be really cool if the three of us got in a room with a bunch of, you know, intermediate to advanced Ruby programmers and worked on Ruby and taught them more advanced Ruby and so on. And thus was born the Complete Rubyist. And the word complete is spelled in the sort of quaint, old-fashioned way with E-A-T at the end. I mean, that's just kind of whimsical. But basically, it's a two-day event. We've done it three times. It's been very successful, very interesting for all of us. I mean, I love sitting there listening to Greg and Jeremy talk about Ruby. It's, you know, I learn a lot when we do it. I think everyone in the room does. We're starting to schedule our 2011 ones. Hopefully we'll have something to announce fairly soon. So it's really the, you know, three friends. We thought of it kind of as like the three tenors of Ruby, you know, three friends who all do Ruby. We've all taught a lot. We've all written a lot. We were all very experienced as Ruby developers and just trying to share that with a group of students.
That's really interesting. Have you ever considered expanding sort of the format into video or some kind of e-learning environment?
We've batted about a number of different ideas. We kind of keep coming back to, you know, it's a little old-fashioned maybe, but the just being in a room with a bunch of people thing, you know, that's kind of a sweet spot for all three of us, I think. Not that we're kind of, you know, opposed to anything else, but I would say, you know, it's not impossible that we would expand into something. I don't think we would replace what we're now doing. In other words, I think what we're now doing has, you know, kind of a momentum and just a sort of value of its own, and maybe could be supplemented with other things. Like I said, it's almost kind of the other way around, because we came at this from all having written Ruby books. So this is actually kind of an outgrowth, in a sense, or a development from having done other things. Where this will go exactly, you know, whether there'll be yet other things, I don't know at this point. But we're still getting a lot out of just the, you know, the old-fashioned 2 days in a classroom thing.
You know, David, in my introduction, I talked about the fact that you co-founded Ruby Central Incorporated, which is the parent organization of something called the International Ruby Conference, or RubyConf. So can you tell us some highlights about the next International Ruby Conference, or RubyConf?
A little bit. It's not probably not until November. October, November is when we usually have the event. The next one, I don't really know much in detail about, like, you know, who the speakers will be or anything like that. I do know, and this is not a promise, but we are hoping to have it in Hawaii. We all would enjoy that. I think a lot of people would enjoy it. Also, it makes it a little bit easier for our Japanese friends and colleagues to attend, although I have to say a number of Japanese Rubyists, including Matt and others, have been to, you know, either all or many or most of the RubyConf events over the years. So I give them enormous credit for that sort of initiative and doing that amount of travel. But still, we're going to try to have it in Hawaii. We're beginning to research venues and so forth. So it's not a promise, but that's usually the first thing we have to nail down is where it's going to be, and then we start to work on the request for proposals and so on. It's still a little bit early for that, for this one, but hopefully it won't be too long before we have some news about it.
Well, that's really interesting about this International Ruby Conference. Can you maybe give me some background, for example, how many do attend these conferences?
Well, it's varied a lot over the years. I can't help sort of pointing back to the old days, the good old days, so to speak, where in 2001 at the first RubyConf, we had, I think it was 33 people. This past year, in 2010, we had the conference in New Orleans, and I think we were in the vicinity of 700 people, something like that. So it's grown a great deal over the years. The event was, as I say, first held in 2001 in Tampa, and has been held every year since then. So we just, in 2010, just had our 10th event. And Matt has been to, I think, 9 of them, if I'm remembering correctly. I know he missed one because his child was being born, but he's been to the vast majority of them and always gives the keynote and is just kind of around and talking to people and so forth. So it's grown a lot. I mean, in part, this is attributable to the Ruby on Rails framework. The attendance at RubyConf, not even RailsConf, I mean, among other things, we started doing Rails events too, but the attendance at RubyConf tripled from, I think, 65 to 200 or something like that in the year that Rails had come out. So Rails caused this kind of surge of, well, popularity of Ruby in general, and certainly in attendance at our events, and it's been growing since then. And as I said, I think last year was about 700. We're not sure how many will be this year, but we're hopeful, and we're still in the planning stages.
Well, you know, in your response, you talked about Mats, and the audience may not be familiar that Mats is really Yukihiro Matsumoto, and he's sort of the creator of Ruby.
He is, absolutely, yes. Matz is his nickname, M-A-T-Z. And he is the creator of Ruby. He's a really interesting person. I've gotten to know him over the years. As I say, he's come to the United States for, I think, 9 of these Ruby conferences. I've also crossed paths with him at the European Ruby conference and elsewhere. Really, really interesting person. Wonderful language designer. I mean, you know, all of this, what I consider kind of great quality of the Ruby language, dates back to his, you know, to his work. And Matz actually created Ruby in 1993, I believe, as really kind of a personal project. He shared it with some friends, didn't, as he tells the story, at least didn't have any particular expectation or ambition for it other than creating a programming language that he really enjoyed using and that hopefully his friends would enjoy using. And Ruby got sort of discovered, so to speak. It became very popular in Japan in the 1990s and then began to kind of become somewhat known outside Japan in that time frame. So by 2000, the first English language Ruby book came out, and that was Programming Ruby by Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt. And at that point, there was a big wave of interest in Ruby outside of Japan. That's actually when I got into it. I discovered Ruby through finding the Programming Ruby book, really just kind of stumbling on it in a bookstore one day. But meanwhile, Matz began then traveling to Ruby conferences and so on. He came to the one in Tampa, the one with 33 people. And it's, you know, I kind of say it almost humorously that the event was so small. But that, I have to say, that first RubyConf, though small, was pretty high-powered. I mean, Matz was there, Dave Thomas, Andy Hunt, Jim Wyrick, Nathaniel Talbot, the guy who wrote Test Unit, and, you know, a sort of large handful of us who, you know, many of whom met each other for the first time at that event and have remained good friends and colleagues over the years. I do have one kind of amusing anecdote about Matz. I like telling this story because it's kind of unique. This goes back, you have to go back to 1995 when I wrote an article. This is long before I knew anything about Ruby. I wrote an article for Linux Journal on the subject of something called Hypernews, which was a messaging, kind of message board system written in Perl, not by me, but I happened to submit this article. So I had an article in Linux Journal, and one kind of cool thing was that they sent me a copy of the Japanese translation. So I had a copy of the, you know, I guess Linux Journal at that point, and maybe still is being translated regularly into Japanese. So they sent me the Japanese edition, which was cool. Of course, I couldn't read it, but it was kind of neat to see my name in there and so forth. So flash forward from 1995 to about maybe 2003, 2004, I was with Matz at some conference, and he said, "Did you write an article about Hypernews for Linux Journal?" And I said, "Yeah, back in 1995. And he said, "I translated that article into Japanese." And it turns out that Matz was actually the translator of my article, which I thought was very funny. So we'd actually kind of crossed paths without knowing each other several years before I even discovered Ruby. And I thought that was kind of cool. I thought that gave me some real Ruby street cred.
You know, that's a great story. It's kind of, you know, maybe it was fated to happen, right?
So. Right, right. Yeah, small world.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, the Association for Computing Machinery, which is the world's largest educational scientific computing society, you know, they have these learning paths, and they asked me if I could, you know, find somebody who could, you know, sort of a world expert who would be willing to help them out and, you know, putting out some information on and, you know, recommendations on how to use Ruby and things like that. So what I did is I actually reached out to Matz, because I'd interviewed him a few years ago, and he recommended you, so that's how we got connected.
Yes, it all comes full circle.
Yeah. So how are you involved then with ACM? Can you get into more detail about what you're doing for the Association for Computing Machinery, or ACM?
Sure. I should say I'm very new to the organization. It's really through your getting me involved with this learning path that I've first been, you know, had any kind of real contact with it, but I've, you know, sort of known of it for a long time. And what I'm doing specifically is developing the, as you say, the Ruby learning path, which I'm envisioning as sort of, well, I've almost used the word grab bag. That sounds a little pejorative, but kind of a cluster, let's say, of different sort of perspectives on Ruby and different things you can do with Ruby. Not a comprehensive cluster, but, you know, for example, I want to have an example of how you write a C extension in Ruby. You know, a small example, but still just showing you that it can be done. I've created or am in the process of creating some kind of annotated code pages with literally sort of, you know, cartoon speech balloons next to the bits of code explaining what they do. And that's actually a kind of cool formula. I've shown that to a couple of people who thought it was really, you know, potentially a really good way to study and learn aspects of the language. I'm planning to include a little bit about JRuby and writing Java from within Ruby code, sort of calling Java classes. And I'm not, by the way, not a big Java expert, but I can, you know, to the credit of JRuby and the bridges that they've created, that I can sort of piggyback fairly easily on Java classes without myself being a Java developer. So yes, I'm trying to create sort of a smorgasbord, so to speak, of just interesting small to mid-sized modules or units about Ruby and illustrating things that Ruby can do. And yeah, and hopefully it'll provide some value for a lot of people coming to Ruby who've used other languages and are just kind of intrigued and want to get a sense of what to do and where to go next.
And I guess there's the other aspect that you are a world-renowned expert. In fact, Mats recommended you. So.
Yes. No, I'm grateful to him. That was very kind. Like I say, it's a small world, even, you know, internationally and everything.
Now, we're going to switch gears a bit, and I'm going to ask questions about more general IT or computing. What can be done to upgrade the employability of recent graduates?
That's an interesting question, and one that I'll be a little bit circumspect about, because I'm not really in the, you know, very much in either the hiring or the educational phase. So it may be that I see a kind of skewed sample, because in some of the clients I've worked with, I actually do see recent graduates, people who, you know, whose first job this is out of college or maybe second job. And so forth. And in terms of employability, you know, it comes down, in my opinion, I in my own mind, keep coming back to what I think of as the idea of agile with a small a. I think the again, you know, being a little bit sort of circumspect, because I don't have a huge sample pool to draw from, but my impression is that the people who do best, and, you know, probably out of college and really throughout their careers, the people who do best are the ones who make themselves adaptable. In other words, who are not necessarily just doing one thing or not necessarily just good at one thing, but are able to take on different technologies, who, and also have, I guess, just a kind of mindset of agility, again, with a small a, in the sense of being adaptable to different situations, to different things that are asked of them. And it's funny because, you know, sometimes you see on somebody's resume a list of like 25 programming languages or something, and you kind of think, wait a minute, they can't really be, you know, totally adept in all of them. But still, and I think that's probably right, but still there's a certain amount of kind of general skill set and willingness to try new things that I think is important. And, you know, sometimes that can be lacking, but I think in a lot of young people, a lot of people coming out of these programs, or even not coming out of, you know, even sort of self-educated, I think there's a lot of versatility and a lot of skill out there in the market.
So what can be done to update the employability of early career, mid-career, and end-career computing professionals?
That's an interesting question. I think, you know, bringing up the early, mid, and end career, it is... From where I sit, it's a very youthful profession. And again, I don't really have statistics on this, and, you know, maybe it really isn't more than others, but I know that I work and have worked with people who are literally half my age. Now, I had a kind of strange career path, so I really came to this kind of in as a second or sort of second and a half career, depending how you measure it. And I don't know. I can only speculate a little bit about, I mean, I've been very fortunate in finding both consulting work, and when I chose to look for full-time work, I did find a full-time job that I really liked. I don't know. My impression is that in terms of hiring, it's somewhat a kind of young person's market. Now, that, again, this is all just sort of thinking out loud. I don't really have sort of facts and figures on this, but it seems to me, you know, that most of the people that I know who are looking for jobs or interviewing for jobs, and in a sense, most of the people I know in this field are pretty young. I mean, there seems to be a lot of beginning career people. And again, my sample is kind of self-selecting because I know people, I get to know people who are in the field and usually who have been successful, not because I kind of shun the unsuccessful, but because I go to conferences and there are people who are, you know, doing this. And at a lot of these conferences, it's fairly conspicuous to me in terms of the demographics. The two things that stand out are, first of all, that it's mostly men. And I mean, that's kind of a whole other kind of sidebar, so to speak. But also that it is a very young field. I'm not the oldest person that I know in the field, but it's certainly kind of weighted toward the beginning. So it's hard for me to, because it's sort of an oblique answer. It's a little bit hard for me to comment directly on employability because, like I said, I don't really have the facts and figures or that much anecdotal evidence. But it feels, I do wonder sometimes, you know, whether it, as it does in other fields, whether it gets a lot harder to find a job as you get older. I mean, that's kind of a cliche of the workplace in general. And I suspect that we're not immune from it either.
Yeah, I'm sort of intrigued. You mentioned that you came from sort of a non-typical background, perhaps. I'm not sure, but I know that you were, what, a cellist, and you still are, and you're a media scholar. You have a PhD in cinema studies. How does somebody from that kind of background get into computing?
Well, it's really, it's even stranger than it sounds. Basically, I got into computing when I was 13 years old, and you have to understand that when I was 13 years old, this was 1972, it was not the case that every 13-year-old used computers. I sincerely doubt there were more than a large handful of them in the country. I stumbled into computing because my junior high school had a PDP-8, and as soon as I walked in the room and saw it when I was in eighth grade, I fell in love with it. I then wandered over to the local university and said, my parents teach here, which they did. You know, I'm an eighth grader. I'm not at the university, but as a family member, is there a computer I can use? And of course, the answer was not really, but we'll let you know. I mean, there was no official program for letting faculty children use the computer lab, but for whatever reason, they did. And the result was that I had a kind of 2-year period of working, I mean, not working for money, but working and playing with and using the PDP-10. And at that point I was 15, I got interested in other things and sort of put that all on the shelf for a long time, but always loved it, always absolutely loved if I ever had a chance to sit down at a computer, I just loved it. So, of course, when I got my first PC, which was, I think, 1987, I gravitated, you know, immediately started thinking about how to program it and started buying programming books and so on and got back into it. Now, meanwhile, as you point out, I had earned a PhD in cinema studies. I had a kind of whole other track that I was interested in, media history and film history, and worked my way through the graduate program at NYU and finished that in 1988. And a few years later, 1992, I got a full-time teaching job at Seton Hall University in the Department of Communication. And I basically spent 13 years teaching, mainly broadcasting, some film studies. My gig was mostly teaching radio and TV history and research to undergraduate. Now, meanwhile, I was also very deeply interested in computers. This was all kind of going on, you know, parallel tracks. And at the university, I was not in the computer field. I was not teaching computer stuff there, but inevitably, I became involved with the computer culture on campus, which was pretty considerable. I was on a lot of kind of faculty technology committees. I was actually the person who first introduced Linux to Seton Hall University. Back in the days where every network jack was a live static IP address in all the dorms and so on, so they clamped down on that eventually, but there was kind of a brief golden age where you could run servers from your office and so forth. So I did some of that. And essentially what happened was that the two parallel, the computer interest and the academic career were a little bit on a collision course, in the sense that especially after I started using Ruby in 2000, my interest in Ruby really kind of outgrew just being a hobby. It was really turning into kind of a second, almost kind of semi-professional pursuit. Even in, I think, 2001, while I was organizing conferences, I was writing book chapters, I was, you know, very involved in the Ruby world. And essentially what happened was the turning point was in 2005. In the fall of 2005, I was supposed to take a year-long sabbatical from teaching and go off and write a book about essentially media theory or media history, a sabbatical project. Well, at that point, I actually already had the contract in hand for the book Ruby for Rails, and I was kind of at a crossroads. I really, my interest in Ruby and in the technology sphere had kind of outpaced my interest in the academic stuff I was doing. And so instead of taking the sabbatical in the fall of 2005, I resigned and basically said, you know, thank you very much. It's been a great career. I'm going to go do something else. And off I went. And then I spent, I think, about 3 or 4 years I spent writing, freelancing, consulting, training. I actually, for about 3.5 years, I was making most of my living as a Ruby and Rails trainer. And then, as I said, toward the end of 2009, I got my full-time job with Cyrus, and I've been with them ever since. So, yeah, it was a case of a, you know, whatever you want to call it, midlife crisis, career change, sort of adjustment, right, as I say, right around 2005. And I'm still at it one way or another.
Well, I guess the world is fortunate, though, because you make so many contributions.
Well, I have been very lucky. I know it sounds like a kind of cliche, but I've been really lucky in being, in some cases, in the right place in the right time. I mean, in the case of Ruby, for example, you know, I got involved with Ruby, as I say, because I stumbled on the book Programming Ruby in a bookstore really just about the week it came out, I think right around the beginning of November in 2000, and was immediately mesmerized by the language. I mean, literally, you know, walking to the cash register with this book, I remember just thinking, wow, this is so cool. And, you know, here I am, whatever, 10.5 years later, kind of still thinking it's really cool. But, you know, at that point, the Ruby community, especially outside of Japan, was small. You know, the mailing lists were very small. The conferences at first were small. We all kind of knew each other. Everybody, you know, you kind of knew everyone on the mailing lists practically. And really, I was positioned well especially when Rails came along in 2004 and the world came kind of knocking at our door. You know, we were this, you know, not exactly cult language, but, you know, kind of small language with, you know, a following, but not as huge a following as some. Especially outside of Japan. I think in Japan, it was, you know, the story was a little different, and the growth of Ruby was earlier. But, you know, we were a relatively small community, and then the world sort of discovered us, and suddenly people wanted to publish books, and, you know, more and more events were taking place, and jobs were coming up, work was coming up, training opportunities, consulting opportunities. And so I was really at, you know, as I say, in the right place at the right time to be visible as a member of the, you know, more or less original community of Ruby developers in the West anyway. Or I'd say I'm kind of second generation. I mean, the really original ones are Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt and others. You know, I mean, they wrote this book through which I discovered Ruby. But I still, you know, I was kind of still in the relatively early stages involved in the community. And so when book contracts started to be available and training opportunities and event organization, I and others who'd been around were sort of naturals for those roles. And so I had that opportunity and could parlay it into an actual career change.
You know, I'm just thinking you've got this sort of remarkable background. You've done a lot of different kinds of things very successfully. So for the computing professional then, you know, from this perspective of, you know, having a long sort of playing with, working with computing, doing programming, but doing things outside of programming. For computing professionals, what specific competencies and skills are in high demand?
That's a good question. Again, my sample pool is not necessarily very representative. I mean, for one thing, I tend to be a little bit skewed toward Ruby. If you look at it from my perspective, like 90% of all developers are doing Ruby, and obviously that's not true. But I tend to move in circles and tend to attend events where there's a lot of, you know, it's sort of top heavy with Ruby programmers. I think the kinds of skills that are available, that are in demand, I think vary a great deal. One impression I've had, again, it's a little bit anecdotal, but one impression that I've had is that there's still life in some of the skills that people just never talk about. I mean, for example, C programming. I've actually had occasion, you know, not too long ago to do a little bit of C programming and to be around people who are doing C programming. And we just never, from one month to the next, you never hear anyone mention C. And if they do, it's sort of a joke almost. So I think, you know, I think there's at least in some places, maybe it's become more of a niche or, you know, less usual, but I think there's life in some of these kind of tried and true technologies. And sometimes it may be that it's, you know, it's code that's being maintained or legacy code or whatever. From what everyone tells me, there's demand for Rails, Ruby on Rails programmers. You know, again, I tend to know a lot of people who are already working in that field, but from, you know, at least sort of anecdotally, it seems like that's in high demand. I think, you know, it's hard to gauge exactly. It seems to me that we're experiencing a wave of interest and popularity in functional programming languages. And some of that, you know, there's vogues for different languages at different times. My understanding of it is that it's tied sort of technically to the idea that functional programming languages, because they are not necessarily maintaining the same kind of state as a procedural or OO language, that functional programming languages fare better in the face of multiple processors. And so there's this whole sort of domino effect of, you know, we've kind of maxed out on some of the processor power, and now we're starting to have multiple processors, and we need architectures, programming language architectures that can make the most out of those. And so I really don't know statistically if this parlays into, you know, how this sort of parlays into job count and so forth. But there's a big push, at least in circles I've seen, toward languages like Clojure and Scala and Haskell, and, you know, basically functional programming languages are having a field day or revival or however you want to look at it. I think, you know, I'm actually convinced that each person should kind of find the things that they like to do and stick to that. I mean, again, as I said earlier, it's not, you know, you don't want to be a kind of one-trick pony, so to speak, but I think there's opportunities in a lot of areas. I think there's, you know, it often comes down to, well, sometimes to luck and being in the right place at the right time, and sometimes to just kind of knowing how to play to your strengths. And as I said, I've been very fortunate in that all kind of falling together for me. In fact, a couple of times in my life, in terms of both my academic career and my computer career, actually been, you know, kind of worked out well in those respects. But I think, you know, to a large extent, I think that, that there are opportunities for people who find the things that they really want to do and become good at it and become impressive at it and become really kind of immersed in it and interested, and that will kind of come through.
So, you know, we talked about the current landscape in terms of competencies and skills, and sort of where do you see this evolving in, let's say, 3 years or 5 years?
That's, you know, it's funny. I have actually made a kind of practice in my life of not trying to look into the future, so I can only give you sort of a non-answer. And the reason I don't look into the future, I mean, it's partly just sort of philosophical thing. But also, I have to say that in my own experience, if I look back over my life, and I think, you know, if I sort of plot points on the continuum, and I say, okay, at that point, where did I think I was going to be 5 years later? And then I look at where I was 5 years later, there's essentially no correlation. I mean, you know, in 2000, if you'd said 5 years from now, you're going to be making your living as a Ruby author and trainer and programmer, I would have said, huh, what's Ruby? Never heard of it. So I've kind of learned through my own experience that five-year plans or three-year, even three-year plans are difficult to make. And correspondingly, I shy away a little bit from predicting the future. I think, though, that we, you know, to use the cliche, we can learn some lessons from the past. One thing about the future, and this concerns me a little bit just in terms of technology, one thing I think we have to think about is this business of obsolescence, particularly obsolescence of software tools and hardware. There's a kind of mania almost for developing projects and then developing them more and then declaring them obsolete and coming up with a substitute and then developing that for a while and then declaring that useless and coming up with a substitute. It's very, very hard to get a kind of stable tool chain where, I mean, you can, but when you try to put a tool chain in place, a lot of the time there's, I don't know what you call it, you know, almost peer pressure or just sort of ebb and flow of what people are doing and what people are promoting and what people are interested in, such that it's almost like before the, you know, metaphorically speaking, before the ink is dried on the paper, you've discovered that, you know, the testing framework that you just set up is actually now considered sort of archaic and you'd better switch to the one that just came out this morning. And the same thing, obviously, in hardware. I mean, in the case of hardware, we're dealing with sort of manufacturing cycles and planned obsolescence and marketing and so forth. In the case of software, and specifically open source software, I think we bring it on ourselves. I mean, I think there's a kind of premium placed on replacing things and acclaiming things as being the greatest thing ever. And sometimes they are. I mean, there's a lot of incredibly great projects, open source projects out there. But sometimes, to my taste anyway, there's just too much churn. There's too much of this, you know, 6 months ago we thought this was the answer to our prayers and now we realize that X, Y, and Z is instead of A, B, and C. And so, I don't know, I think about projects like Tech, Donald Knuth typesetting system, which he wrote and finished. It was a project. He did it. It's done. And it has been done for a long time. He accepts bug reports. I don't think he gets very many at this point. But it's not like, you know, version 11.3.6 has to come out and then version 12 has to come out and version 13. It was an idea. He implemented it and it's there and we can use it. I wish there were more of that. And again, sort of tying this back to your question of 3 to 5 year cycles, I kind of wish, I don't know, there were more tools that didn't change, maybe would be one way to put it. I think that's something that communally we have to evaluate. I mean, I should add, I'm not trying to second guess anybody who, you know, writes a great tool and wants to improve it. I completely understand and admire that. But at the same time, this feeling that you can't really put in place a tool chain because you know that there'll be, you know, a blog post soon about something else that's twice as good. And even if you don't think it is, somebody at work will think it is, and you'll have to kind of decide which one to use. And then it will kind of bifurcate again in 6 months. And, you know, that kind of thing. I would like to see us take a step back and kind of examine exactly why that is and why there can't be somewhat more stability or longevity, I would say, in some of these tools.
That's interesting. I guess that won't happen, though, right, the way things go.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this gives me an opportunity to express some of the concern and desires. But, yeah, I mean, if you ask me to predict in 3 years, will that have really changed? I would say no. But maybe people will start thinking about it or kind of reacting to it. It's exhausting. I mean, that's what it comes to. It's exciting, but kind of exhausting to have to keep replacing things and to have so much of what we do and our sort of relationship to our field involve the keeping up with new tools and new versions of things and so forth. I don't, by the way, I do not have a kind of, you know, prefab solution to this. I don't have a sort of, you know, sort of quantitative, well, after you've worked on a project for X amount of time, you should just stop. I mean, that would be silly. And as I say, I admire very much the people who are producing some of these things. And it's certainly, if they think it's in their interest to keep working on it or change it, then by all means they should. But it just, it leaves us with a kind of, you know, a kind of texture of impermanence to the whole thing and feeling like what we do is we read blog posts and find out about new stuff and then decide whether to use it. And I think if that loomed a little less large and if some of the things were a little more permanent, that might be good. It's also true that I'm almost certainly, you know, skewing the argument a little bit. I mean, if you really look at, well, I mentioned C earlier. I mean, you know, there are tools that are sort of more or less there. I mean, it does some of the compilers change and so forth, and now and then they issue an updated standard. But yes, there are things that are just kind of there, and it may just be the milieu that I'm in, where there just seems to be, as I say, a lot of churn, and maybe we could find opportunities or areas where that could be toned down a little bit.
Now, what are the best resources then to keep computing professionals upgraded? Like, what do you use? Where do you look for computing resources?
I'm actually very old school. I read books. I talk to people. I try things out. I emphasize, actually, coming back to books, I actually not only write but do read computing books. And I don't know, for me at least, I think everyone learns a little differently. But over the years, I have just gotten tremendous mileage out of just, you know, sitting there with books and reading them and maybe working through examples. I sometimes get too impatient to do that. But you know, for me, books, I don't subscribe to any journals. It's not sort of a position statement. I just don't happen to have done that at this point. But I know there certainly are some very valuable journals out there. There's professional organizations. Obviously, ACM is kind of a hub and a leader in that area. And really contact with people. I mean, one of the things that was motivating me when I changed from being a consultant to working full time, you know, there were a number of factors that led up to that, but one of them was that I really missed having colleagues. I really missed having a group of people that I was in the workplace with. And I do actually go to my job. I mean, you know, it's not a telecommuting job. So, but even if it were, you know, just people that I'm associated with that are my colleagues that I can share ideas with, and even going back to what I was saying about tools and so forth, even people who can, you know, come in one day and say, hey, I've discovered this cool new tool or whatever. I think there's no substitute for that. And as much as I like consulting and training and so forth, I really was glad when I started work full-time and actually had kind of day-to-day colleagues with whom I could share things, off of whom I could bounce ideas and so forth. And, you know, that may take the form of a workplace, may take the form of user groups, it may take the form of mailing lists, you know, depending what your comfort zone is. But I think that's very important just to kind of stay in touch. And by the way, I'm actually really bad at it. I mean, I'm woefully out of touch. I'm always the last person to adopt some technology, and sometimes I'll just skip one. You know, I'll just say, well, whatever, some version control system has come out. I'm just using that as an example. You know, some whatever has come out, and everybody's using it, and I wake up one day and realize I've never heard of it, and it's, you know, it's the hottest new thing. And sometimes I think, well, if I just ignore it, maybe I can sort of skip a cycle and try to get in on the next one. Because, I'm actually really bad at sort of being current with cool new things. But I rely on people to tell me or prod me into it if it's something that's really conspicuously missing in my toolkit.
Now, if you could sum up your life experiences with career tips for the computing professional, what would be your tips?
My tip, as I said earlier, the main, I guess the thing I come back to in my own mind a lot is this idea of agility with a small a. I suppose I'm playing both sides of the fence a little bit because I also think you should be really, you know, expert at the things that you list on your resume and so forth. But you should be adaptable and kind of make a virtue of necessity. I mean, I've had jobs where I went in doing Ruby and ended up doing also some JavaScript or some C or whatever. And, you know, I mean, that was very good for me and in fact, very interesting. It doesn't mean everything has to be equally interesting to you. But, you know, be a bit adaptable. I also, by way of just kind of life coach experience, so to speak, you know, one thing that people face a lot of the time and that I've, as you can tell from some of my stories about my own career path, something that I faced a lot is deciding what to do next. you know, all right, I'm a professor. Should I abandon my academic career and follow this other path? I was a musician. I actually never made my living full time as a musician. I am a musician, I should say. But I had to make the decision at a certain point. Do I want to try to do that? Or at that time in my life, it was really between that and my academic work. And I chose, you know, for various reasons, my academic work. It seems to me, I don't know if it's just my perception of it. It seems to me there's a lot of decision making in our field. There seems to be a lot of movement among jobs. You know, maybe again, this may be a function of being young, of people who are young, moving around a lot. There seem to be, in some cases, career path decisions. I know I'm not the only person who's come to the technical world from somewhere else or who's been involved, music specifically, not exclusively, but there's a lot of musicians in the technical world, and I know that some of them have made the choice to make their living doing something other than music and so on. And even, you know, this sort of extends to things like where to live, as well as what job to have, and so forth. And anyway, the advice that I give myself, and that, you know, is probably about the closest to life coach advice I can come up with that I hope will be valuable to people is, given a choice between A and B, if you're already doing A, you know, you have job A, and somebody says, do you want job B? And you're agonizing over it, and you're not sure, and there's sort of pros and cons to both of them. Here's my approach to that. My approach is to say, if I already had job B, would I accept job A? In other words, if I were in the altered state, would I want to go back to the previous state? The answer, by the way, is really very often no. And it often turns out that the hesitation to change jobs or, you know, or move to a different city or whatever it may be, the hesitation is because of the how cumbersome the process is. The thought of, you know, the churn in your life and the paperwork and the newness of it and so on. I always think if you cut through to looking at it as just two states of life, you know, state A and state B, if you were in state B, would you be trying to get back to state A? And it's so often the case that it's not true. And that really helped me make my decision to leave the academic world and pursue Ruby stuff. Again, the timing was good. It was at a time when it was becoming possible to get paying work as a Ruby trainer, as a Ruby professional, as a programmer, and so on. But, you know, I looked at what I was doing, and I said, well, yes, you know, resigning from a tenured university position is a huge deal. It's not easy. It's not, you know, this is a big decision. But I thought, okay, if I waved the magic wand and I just was a Ruby person, you know, if I just could make it just happen instantaneously, I'm a Ruby programmer, that's how I make my living, would I then be trying to get back to the academic life? And it was such a clear no at that point in my life. It was so clear that I wouldn't, in fact, be pining away for this, that I realized that my only hesitation, again, was the process, the thought of actually sitting down and writing a letter to the provost, actually resigning, changing the health insurance, you know, all this kind of thing. But I realized that once I got through that, I would, in fact, be somewhere that I wanted to be. And that's what kind of drove me through that decision.
Now, can you profile what is needed for computing professionals to be successful in today's agile-driven sort of technology climate?
I would say it's to my mind, a being sort of attuned to the relationship between process and results. Now, that sounds like a cliche. I mean, everything we do in life is process and results. But it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned agile methodology specifically, and it's interesting to me because, in a certain sense, the whole notion of an agile methodology is, well, it's not, I was going to say contradiction in terms, it's not a contradiction in terms, but there's a sort of creative tension there. And here's what I mean by that. If you're really agile, then if somebody walks in one day and says, okay, we don't do agile anymore, then you should be so adaptable that even that is okay, right? So agile, it's like, it is a methodology or a philosophy or whatever you want to call it, that in some ways is sort of at war with itself. And to make the truce with itself, it actually has to have some rules and regulations that really are rules, and that that if you don't do them, you're really not doing agile. And I often think, well, you know, agility should, you know, perhaps encompass changing methodologies. So like I say, the agile methodology, I think, has a kind of creative tension where it's, you know, it's sort of almost, it almost contains the seeds of its own destruction, but if you do it right, it doesn't have to. But I would say being attuned to that is really important. I mean, if you have clients, let's say, where, you know, they're not, maybe their methodology is kind of scrappy and they're looking to you partly for sort of clearing up what they're doing, not just for you to be churning out code, though maybe that too. But, you know, let's say you have a client who brings you in because you want to, because they want to improve their process. But then, you know, maybe there's someone at the company who's very, very results driven, you know, not that interested in process, especially if it looks like it's going to add time to things rather than save time. I think it's just having, there's no one sort of recipe or one answer for this, but it's just being attuned to the relation between process and results. And I very personally, very strongly believe that practices like clean code, you know, concepts of clean code, concepts of refactoring code, pair programming, though I'm not doctrinaire about that. I think some people thrive without it, but in some cases I think it's a really great idea. But, you know, some of these things to try to implement them while being attuned to the fact that, you know, whatever you believe, you're also going to be probably encountering people who question it, and you want to, you know, without being kind of doctrinaire about it, you want to be able to represent the process as well as the outcome. And I think, you know, I mean, to me, that's largely what's going on nowadays is this, and, you know, it's not particularly new, but some of the stuff I think has been very, very successful and produced a lot of great outcomes. Some of the dealing with process, with kind of coming to terms with again dealing with the realities of results, but sticking to the idea that a good process will produce the best results. They're not in conflict, but they do have to be continually, I think, monitored and fine tuned.
Now we're down to our final questions here in the interview. So in this next question, what do you see as the top challenges facing us today? And how do you propose they be solved?
We've already talked about a couple of them. This business of obsolescence, I see that as a challenge for our field. And as I said, I don't have a sort of recipe for fixing it, but I think that's something we'll definitely have to be monitoring. I think other challenges include just the ongoing need for education. I mean, this is, and it's funny because although I'm an educator, you know, I've been a university professor and I've been a corporate trainer. I've never been a university professor in computers. So there, you know, I certainly knew computer students and as I mentioned earlier, I know people who are more or less just out of school and doing computer jobs and so on. But I hear a lot about, well, yeah, I mean, you hear this in a lot of fields, but different reports of whether or not the formal education really helps in the workplace. And I like to think it does. I mean, I taught, when I was teaching history and research. And so, my classroom was not even a technical class. We also had people teaching you how to use TV cameras and so on. I was doing kind of the history and kind of theoretical side of it. I think that to the extent that there is, I don't know, a gap or a perceived gap between formal education and readiness for the workplace, I'd like to think that would be kind of worked through by people. I get uneasy when I hear people say, oh, you know, who needs a degree? Who needs this? Now you just, you know, show up at an interview and dazzle them and then you'll learn everything on the job. I actually think people sometimes underestimate how much they've learned from their formal education and during their formal education. I mean, maybe the years that you're studying, you know, maybe you can't connect the dots exactly from, you know, what you learn in each textbook to what you do at your first job, but you spent those years becoming good at stuff and learning about stuff, and that will help. And so, you know, I would like to think that people will, you know, continue to pursue formal education in our field, And obviously there's, you know, there's any amount of it in terms of the theory and the science as well as the practice and the tools and so forth. And that education won't, you know, as I say, I kind of worry that education, formal education gets a little bit of almost a bad rap. And I'm not saying that that all formal education is flawless and it should be given the benefit of every doubt. But I'd like to think that over time, you know, that would go in the direction of education being very helpful without necessarily just becoming sort of vocational training. I like the idea of kind of educational underpinnings, and I think that's something we have to keep an eye on.
Now, we've covered a lot of topic areas and, you know, in sort of our conversation here. Now, I'm going to turn the tables.
Okay.
Now, if you were conducting this interview, what additional questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
One thing I would ask, coming upon somebody like me who is, you know, in many respects a Ruby specialist, or, you know, certainly do Ruby mostly in my writing and my teaching and my programming, one question, and this is one I've asked myself occasionally, is what is my second favorite programming language? It's actually very hard to answer. I think the answer is probably C, but I'm not absolutely certain. I used to be a bit of a language collector, actually. I became kind of specialized, but I used to be more, I don't know, kind of language junkie. I think Matt has used that phrase about himself. And to some extent, that side of me is kind of coming back, kind of roaring back in the last year or so. I've been looking at a number of other languages. But anyway, that's something I sometimes ponder. You know, there's no question what my favorite programming language is, but what is my second favorite? And at this point, I mean, it may fluctuate, but at this point, I'd probably say C. But you know, that's just me. There's no advice lurking there. I just find it quite fascinating. I might ask, what is the best thing about Ruby? Now, this is a loaded question, and it's a very sappy answer, but the answer to me is the best thing about Ruby is the community. I was involved with the community when it was very small, and it was wonderful and incredibly sort of nurturing and collegial. It's gotten a lot bigger, but I have to say, I think given that getting bigger means things are going to change, and it's not going to be, you know, exactly the same experience that it was in 2000 or 2001. Even factoring that in, I think we've done an incredible job of remaining friendly, collegial, open, nurturing. I mean, yes, you get people on the mailing list who go into their little tirades at each other and all that stuff, but I think we have a relatively low frequency of that kind of thing. Another question I might ask would be about upcoming writing projects. And it's funny I should ask myself that, because there's actually I'm a little bit in hiatus. I'm actually working on a book whose working title is Rails Choices. And it is a book about essentially the things in Rails that you have to decide about. When you're starting up a Rails application, like whether you're going to use one type of session storage or another, whether you're going to use a particular test framework or another, and so forth. And I've actually done this book is being written under contract with the Pragmatic Bookshelf. I've actually done a fair amount of work on it. It's funny though, you know, speaking of tools superseding themselves, it's been held up a little bit by the appearance of Rails 3. I'm trying to kind of absorb Rails 3 and then go back to the book, partly because Rails 3 is much more modular than Rails 2. So I'm faced with, you know, thinking just about what topics to talk about when I talk about Rails choices. I have to kind of re-examine exactly what that means in the context of Rails 3. So we are adopting a wait and see attitude on this book, but hopefully it won't be, you know, sort of infinitely postponed. I might ask myself about upcoming teaching projects. We talked a little bit before about the Complete Rubyist, the teaching that I do with Gregory and Jeremy. I'll just mention briefly we're thinking of planning events in Baltimore and Boston in the next maybe 4 to 5 months. So stay tuned for that. That should be very exciting. I think both of those areas have big Ruby presences, and I think the event would do well there. So that's probably most of what else I'd ask. I might also ask that same question, so I can be sort of like a linked list, right? My last question is, what are your questions?
You know, I'm just thinking of your questions here and your answers, and you talked about the community and how important it is. Well, how big is the community? Do you have a sense of the size of it?
I really don't. You know, it's funny. I like I said before, my sample is skewed. If you look at the world through, you know, ruby colored glasses, so to speak, you know, I just disproportionately know Ruby programmers, and I know that there are people who are doing, you know, that the Java events are bigger than our events and all that kind of thing. I really honestly don't have numbers. I mean, I wish I did. I know that Ruby user groups that I've been to have, you know, meetings, let's say in New York or London or Philadelphia, they have meetings with 25, 40, 60 people like that. And to me, that means there must be, you know, sort of thousands of people doing this. Of course, Ruby also, one of the interesting things about Ruby, and I don't know if it's unique, but it's unusual, is this the fact that it originated in Japan, and, you know, there's a ton of communication between the Japanese Ruby community and the Ruby community outside of Japan, which is, you know, largely, though not entirely, English-speaking. But it also means that whatever is going on here, there's also a lot of stuff going on there, and that's, you know, and Ruby has had a somewhat different trajectory. I mean, Ruby was very popular in Japan in the 1990s by the time it kind of migrated outward. And, you know, there's another area where, again, I really don't have numbers, but I remember as early as 2000, people were saying, you know, the sort of buzzword was Ruby is more popular than Python in Japan. Now, I have no idea who said that or whether it was backed up by numbers or anything, but that was, you know, even whatever, 10 or 11 years ago, that was the sort of catchphrase for Ruby in Japan. So I wish I did have numbers. It's just something I don't have at my fingertips, but I can say it sort of qualitatively, it's a at least a medium to large size community and growing all the time, I'm happy to report.
Now, you've talked about Japan. Have you been to Japan?
I have not. I really want to go. They have now, for I think the last 3 or 4 years, there has been a big Japanese Ruby convention, the Ruby Kaiji, and I would really love to go to it, and we'll see. Maybe this summer I'll manage to get over there. I have never been there, but I would like to.
And I guess the other thing, too, is that you talk about Rails 3. What are the best things in Rails 3?
From what I've seen, the best things include the active relation framework, which is basically a way of modeling queries that uses Ruby syntax, specifically Ruby method chaining syntax, to build up a query in a kind of lazily evaluated way, a database query. So you say, you know, users.find all dot where name begins with the dot order ascending and so forth. And I have to say, I'm personally not a big fan of the necessarily kind of visually of a lot of method chaining. I mean, you know, the sort of dot this, dot that, dot the other thing. In this particular case, it's in the service of kind of domain specific architecture. And what it does is that it, you know, you call dot order, dot where and so forth. Dot limit and everything, and it builds one query and just goes to the database lazily when it needs to, when you actually examine the result. So it's, in that sense, it's a I think, improved architecture for that. I like some of the changes they've made to the routing syntax, just simplified it, kind of weeded out some of the verbiage that was in the routing. And yeah, generally, I think it's, you know, it's a kind of neatening up and refitting of the thing in what I think is a successful way.
You know, Ruby's been out there for a number of years. Now, what kind of influence does Mott still have on this sort of entire Ruby ecosystem? It must be so large that he can't really control all the threads anymore, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he is still the designer of Ruby. I mean, he is the final arbiter of what is Ruby. And it's become, an interesting question in relation to the fact that there's now more than one Ruby interpreter. In other words, there's the MRI, MATS's Ruby interpreter, but there's also JRuby and Rubinius and IronRuby and MacRuby and various Ruby interpreters. So the question, you know, sort of generally arises, what exactly is Ruby? You know, if you write an interpreter, can you call it Ruby if it does, you know, if it performs or behaves exactly the same way as Matz's interpreter, or, you know, can Matz sort of tell you not to call it Ruby and so forth? And it's really been great because all of the people who are implementing versions of Ruby have been collaborating with each other and working on questions of standards. I believe there is work being done toward an ISO standard, though it's not there yet, but I believe that's happening. There's also the Ruby Spec project, which is a large suite of tests, essentially, that define behavior and that represent a kind of core set of behaviors that anyone writing a Ruby interpreter can write to. And if they do successfully write to it, they can expect compatibility across, you know, most or all of the existing Ruby interpreters. So Matz is still, you know, the head of it. He describes himself as a benevolent dictator, and he's still in that position. But given that there are other interpreters, a lot of these questions have arisen. But I have to say, I think it's been handled in a kind of exemplary way in terms of collegiality and collaboration and so forth among the various implementers.
Now, to finally close off, why Ruby? And in three or four sentences.
Why Ruby? I can actually tell you why I use Ruby in one word, namely the word love. And that is not usually considered a technical term, but the fact is that, you know, there I was in November of 2000 pulling this book off the shelf in Borders, the bookstore, and just fell in love with the language. I mean, I can't explain it any other way. I'm in a kind of weird position as a sort of Ruby, I don't know, evangelist or advocate or whatever, because I have actually never come up with a set of reasons to use Ruby. Ruby sells itself. I mean, I think, and this again, going back to the learning path for ACM, this is kind of my driving philosophy, that it's not so much a matter of getting people to understand why they should use Ruby. It's a matter of putting people in a position to see Ruby and to really see Ruby and to see what it does and what it's like and what it offers. Now, it's not going to convince everyone, but generally the way people get into Ruby is through Ruby. And so creating opportunities for that to happen, to me, that's what Ruby advocacy really is.
You know, David, I'm just kind of reflecting on our conversation here. And, you know, I started programming back in, the late 60s. And I'm thinking, maybe I'll dust off my shingle and start programming in Ruby. You got me really passionate and excited about it.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad.
You know, David, I really enjoy this time with you. And I know your schedule is very demanding. And, you know, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our interview with David A. Black, co-founder, Ruby Central, the International Ruby Conference, and the Complete Rubyist. David A. Black is an international top-ranking Ruby programmer, author, trainer, speaker, and event organizer.